Welcome to this first university colloquium of this academic year. I'm very happy that we get to kick it off with an interesting speaker, Peter Rowlands. Some of you probably heard him speak in chapel this morning. Peter is comes from Northern Ireland, but also I think these days owns some American identity or at least residency for part of the year. So we're happy to claim him as well. Peter Rowlands did his doctoral work at Queen's University in Belfast. He's written a number of interesting books. If you don't know anything else about him, if you look at his CV, you will discover very quickly that he has a gift for designing provocative titles. The first book that he wrote that got him a lot of attention was How Not to Speak of God. More recently, he's published a couple books that, again, have been widely read. In 2011, Insurrection, To Believe is Human, To Doubt Divine. And in 2013, The Idolatry of God, Breaking Our Addiction to Certainty. Peter's thought and writing has had a profound influence on what has come to be called a movement that's come to be called the Emergent Church Movement. And he's a popular speaker and writer at a number of events where people are trying to think about alternative ways of being church and being people of faith in the world. His work, among other things, makes a profound critique, I believe, of religion as an institution and religious institutions in particular. So you might wonder why we're inviting him to come here and spend so much time in our religious institution. It might seem a little bit like inviting the Trojan horse into your living room. But I think it's important if we're going to be a creative and interesting and helpful institution in the world that we take regular occasion to hold our underlying assumptions up to the light of inquiry and ask the most difficult questions of those assumptions. And today's conversations give us an opportunity to do that. It's important that our assumptions not just be taken for granted, but that they actually be problematic, that they be things we examine and own or discard. So Peter, thanks for helping us think about these important questions. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello, thank you very much. I'm an institutionalist. I love institutions. I think Christianity can be an institution that deconstructs itself. I mean, the most radical person for me is not the one who kind of creates something new necessarily, but the one who finds a potentiality that already exists in the present. I mean, you have, you know, in philosophy, you've got the potential, which doesn't exist, and you've got the actual, and actualization is the potential that's happened. But if you think of it in a different way, that actuality, the actually existing something, has potentiality always within it. And the radical is the one who's always trying to find where's that potential that exists in the actually existing community that can open itself up, that can deconstruct itself, that can reformulate itself, always reforming. So I'm an institutionalist for a lot of reasons, but because I think also we need each other. We need rituals. We're ritualistic beings. We need funerals and weddings, and we need ways of engaging and ritualizing in life. So I'm a big fan of the church, but I want an institution that deconstructs itself. So this is the kind of environment that I love to be in, an environment where a community is going, yes, you know, we acknowledge the need and the importance to always be asking difficult questions. And what I want to do in the next 45 minutes is it's kind of a big thing to try. I'm going to try to say why I think Christianity is interesting, or why I am a Christian. I'm going to try to, you know, talk about sin and salvation and Christianity and all of that, but maybe look at it in a slightly different way. So I want to imagine, you know, you've come in through a veil of ignorance and you've forgotten everything you know about Christianity, and I'm going to offer a different lens. And in a sense, I'm not asking you at this point to agree or disagree with me, but in one sense, just kind of have a look at this lens and see if it's useful, see if it brings to light anything that might have previously been obscure. So it's kind of not my bells and whistles, lots of stories, lots of jokes thing. I'll maybe do a couple of those, but this is a more serious, you know, philosophical and theological lecture I want to give. And I guess I want to start, I'm going to use a little bit from my book, Idolatry of God, but also the new one, which isn't out yet, called The Divine Magician. And in The Divine Magician, I explore how there's this link between magic and religion that's interesting. There was an Archbishop of Canterbury who discovered this when he noticed that hocus pocus sounded an awful lot like horcas corpus, you know, what the priest says in mass. And that the patter, for example, that magicians do, so magicians do a patter, comes from paternoster, you know, the kind of repetitive prayers of the monks. And this is interesting, you know, these phrases were taken by magicians at the time, and kind of like, almost like, you know, Tillotson, the Archbishop, was like, this is a mockery of the Eucharist. The Eucharist is a magic trick, you know, where something, where the priest comes out and says hocus pocus, and something's transformed miraculously. And Tillotson, as a kind of like a modernist, was trying to say, no, the Eucharist isn't like a magic trick. It's not like a magic trick. It's something else. It's about remembering Christ or whatever. And then, of course, the Catholic Church would want to distance it from a magic trick as well. You say, it's not, the Eucharist is not a magic trick. What I want to argue here is actually I think it is. I think that we could look at the Eucharist and we could look at the central message of Christianity as a type of magic trick. And I'm going to kind of argue why that's the case. But one thing you should know is a magic trick, you know, kind of has three parts, and a disappearing illusion. I know a few tricks like this. There's one, I make a coin disappear. I kind of rub it into my elbow. And what you do is you have what's called Christopher Nolan's film The Prestige, if you've seen it, kind of goes through these three elements. You have the pledge. The pledge is where I have an object, a coin, and I show you the coin, right? That's the pledge. Here's the object. And then there is the turn. I take this coin and I start to rub it into my elbow. And the turn is the coin disappears into my elbow. That's the turn, the disappearance of the object. At that point, people are just, where is it? A trick always has to have the third part. And the third part is the prestige. And the prestige is the return of the coin. And I lift up a beer glass and there it is. Right? So that's a basic, very basic trick. Now, of course, most of these classic vanishing acts, the way they work is what you get back is not what you lost. You know, the bird, like in the prestige, the bird that the magician makes disappear, it's dead. Sad to say, it's crushed. When a magician makes a bird disappear, usually it's by breaking its neck. And the bird that comes back is a different bird. And we all think it's the same bird. The coin that I make disappear into my elbow, it's in the back of my neck. And the coin that's under the beer glass, it's a different coin. It's the return of what you think is the same, but it's different. There's another magic trick I know. Very simply, I give you two cards from the top of the deck. And I look at them. There are nine of clubs and a six of spades. And that's fine. You look at them. And then I get you to put them somewhere in the pack separately. And then I shake the pack frantically, right, until there's only two cards left in my hand. I just shake it until they all fall on the ground, and then I flick over the two cards, and they're your two cards. It's like, wow, how did you do that? Well, I do that because I give you back two different cards. I give you, say, the six of clubs and the nine of spades. I give you back the nine of clubs and the six of spades. But your brain, you know, thinks that you're getting the same cards back, same suits, same numbers, same color. You get back in the prestige something different. So bear that in mind, the three parts of a magic trick. And now we're going to go back to the very beginning, to Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve is an interesting story. You've got these two people. By the way, they almost didn't have this. We almost didn't get this. So I had three people who were going to act this out, Adam and Eve and the object of desire. So, which would have been quite fun, actually. I wish I'd done it. But we've got Adam and Eve. And they're walking around the garden, they can name all the animals, everything's great, everything's hunky-dory. And then, interestingly, there's one tree, suddenly into this, there's one tree that they can't eat from, right? One tree, you can't eat of this. This is a tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Can't do it. And the first question that arises with this is like, well, why? What makes that tree, first of all, magical? What makes this tree so special? Now, in a sense, what you can say is, well, it's very simple. The tree is magical and desirous because of the prohibition. You know, anyone who's got kids knows if you say to a kid, don't open that cookie jar when I leave, it's like suddenly they want to open the cookie jar. If a kid says, I would like really like a puppy for Christmas, you say, you can't have a puppy for Christmas. God, I really want the puppy for Christmas. I really want the puppy for Christmas. I really want the puppy for Christmas. The prohibition generates the excessive desire. If one kid is playing with a toy and the other kid sees it and comes over and the other kid say, no, I can't have it. The other kid's like, well, you know, I understand you're playing with it, but I respectfully would really enjoy playing with it. And the other child said, I don't think you fully understand. I've got the toy. You're going to have to wait your turn. And the other child's like, well, okay, I think we're getting off on the wrong foot here. I think I misplayed what I was saying. I really want the toy. It's very important to me. Well, I think you'll find that now I really want the toy. And then suddenly it degenerates into this kind of crazy mess, right? The prohibition, this is the Freudian insight and the insight of Paul, which we'll come to in a second, which is the prohibition generates the very desire for what it holds off. What it says you cannot have, it makes you really, really want it. And so, you know, in a very simple level, you know, this story, you've got Adam and Eve, and they've got this prohibited tree, and oh my goodness, it becomes incredibly desirous, something you really want. This, I can't get into this here, but this mimics and will continue to mimic what you see in psychoanalytic discourse, where the first experience of the child with self-consciousness, your consciousness of self involves consciousness of something that is non-self. Consciousness of the inner world is consciousness also of the outer world. And the first object of desire is, you know, the primary caregiver. The first experience of separation is really being separated from the mother's breast, in a sense. That's the first experience of kind of, whoa, I want that back. And the weaning process, which is this prohibition, is a very, you know, traumatic thing for a child, where they, in one sense, have to separate from the mother. And if that doesn't happen, something awful takes place. You know, they become Irish, right? That's why Jesus was Irish. You know, he lived with his mum till he was 30, and she thought he was God. This is the one that caught between a rock and a hard place. This is the first experience. Either you separate from your mother, and that's really depressed, and you know, you want to go back, or you don't, and that's even worse, right? This structure, you know, I'm not going to go into that here in detail, but, you know, Adam and Eve, you've got, they're separated from this tree, and now they really want it. Just to kind of put this help me understand this, take the story of a guy who's deeply in love. He's in love with this girl who's in his art class, but she hasn't really paid any attention to him. And so one day, like, he's really good at art, by the way. He's brilliant, absolutely fantastic, top of his class, and she's rubbish, really awful, right? Really terrible artist. And one day he's waiting for her, you know, down by the stairs, and because she always passes by, and at least he gets to say hello to her. And he hears some of the classmates, these two girls, talking about how bad at art she is. And he hears them, like, laughing and all of that. But then she comes in, you know, comes down the stairs, and the two girls stop. And they become sickly sweet, and they're saying, oh, you know, you're a really good artist. Oh, you know, you're much better than you think. And then they go, you know, there's an art prize at the end of semester. You should enter it. You know, I really think you've got a chance of winning, right? And the girl's like, no, I'm really bad at art. I wouldn't do that. But then a week later, she comes up to this guy. He's a really good artist. And she says, listen, would you come back to my place tonight? I want to show you something. And he's like, oh my goodness, she's never really noticed that I've been alive before. And now she's inviting me back to her house. So he goes to the house and she shows him this painting, really terrible painting, really awful painting, you know. And she says, what do you think? And of course, he loves her, so he lies. You know, he's like, oh, it's beautiful, it's brilliant, it's amazing, I really love it. And she's like, oh, right, so you should think I should enter it into the competition. He's like, oh, yeah, of course. So now he's implicated in this plot to humiliate the girl, to put this terrible piece of art into this prize and look stupid in front of the whole school. So what does he do? Well, a day before the day of the submissions, he puts his painting in, and he goes into the room and he finds her painting and he takes it. And he also takes a couple of other ones that are good. He puts them in his pocket and he knows there's cameras, but he doesn't mind, he doesn't care, and he takes them. And then about a week later, he's brought before the principal. He said, listen, we know you stole these paintings. Why did you do it? And he says, well, you know, I wanted to win the prize so much that I took the best paintings. So he was suspended. Girl never talked to him again. But he protected her from humiliation. Now, what's interesting about this story is, in a sense, if you think about it, a bad painting was stolen. And the bad painting created the illusion of a great painting that would never be. You can kind of ask whether he did a good thing or a bad thing for the woman, you know. But when you take something mundane and you take it away, it creates the illusion that there was something amazing that could have won the prize. So the taking away of something mundane creates the illusion of something fantastic that then creates the fantasy that I could have won. And in a similar way, when you prohibit something like this, this mundane object is taken away, subtracted from the world, and this subtraction from the world creates what you can call an idol, an object that you think will make you whole and complete, an object that you think, wow, if only I could get that, that would be amazing. Now, this is interesting because desire operates in that you want something, I want this or that, but in this sense, something more is created. So you just desire stuff, oh, the fruit of that tree looks nice. But when it's prohibited, desire becomes drive, this obsessive drive for the object that you can't have. And drive is interesting because it seems like human beings are the only ones that have this. Is, you know, we're talking about this earlier, but animals seem to be very utilitarian creatures. They've done experiments where they got mice and they put them in a cage. And in the cage, you'll see this mimics this. You put really nice food behind a glass sheet, and then you've got the animals here. And what the animals try, and they've got really rubbish food here, the smelly food. And at first, the mice bounce against the glass to try and get the good food. And then they turn around and they eat the rubbish food. Simple experiment. But then they took the mice out of the cage. They played with their brains like scientists do and stuck them back in. And what they did is they got the mice to bounce against the glass for the good food. And they just kept bouncing against the glass until they died. They wouldn't renounce it. They made little human beings, little zombies. They made zombies. And that's the thing about zombies. Zombies are a cinematic representation of drive. So a zombie is very selfless. If a zombie comes at you and you have a shotgun, it doesn't stop. It just keeps on coming at you. And you can say, stop, 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 it doesn't matter. It's selfless. The alien out of Aliens is another material representation of drive. This object that will just go for what it wants and go to kill the human, and nothing will stop it until you destroy it. In fact, interestingly, what you see with the film Aliens is they eventually create an origin story for the alien in Prometheus, the latest in the trilogy, where basically they go, you know, because the question always has been, where is this alien from? What is this alien that is so alien to us? And the answer is fascinating, because what Prometheus says is, well, at the very beginning, there is this alien creature, and this alien creature drinks this black substance, and then he dies, and he breaks down, and his DNA goes into the water of this lifeless planet, right? And that DNA becomes the building blocks for all of life, and the implication is this is the planet Earth millions of years ago. And then you go to present day, just after present day, and they discover that these aliens exist. And this very wealthy person gets a space expedition to go out and find them. They go to this planet to find them. And they go out to the planet and they find the black substance. And this android touches the black substance and nothing happens. It's just inert. But when the black substance touches human beings, when a human being consumes the black substance, it eventually gives birth to the alien. So the mythology has always been the alien is a type of weapon of mass destruction. The black substance is some sort of military weapon. But actually in Prometheus, what you discover is, no, the black substance is simply creates the material essence of this of the object that consumes it. So whatever the inner life of the being is, so the beings who embrace death, you know, the engineers, they're called, they create life. But interestingly, the human beings, because you learn that this guy who set up the expedition, he's about 100 years old, he doesn't want to die, he refuses to die. And so he wants immortality. And it's this person, and everybody on this space station is looking for something. One is looking for money, one's looking for knowledge, one's looking for, fame. They're all driven, the drive, they've all got the obsessive drive. And so when they come in contact with the black substance, it generates a material manifestation of an inner life. So the alien is us. It's the creature from inner space, the part of ourselves that causes us to act against ourselves. And this is the problem with Ayn Rand, of course. Who Ayn Rand saying, well, you know, you selfishly just want something. You kind of, so, you know, the you know, you just capitalism and stuff like that just feeds our selfish want. But that's the problem with capitalism in that kind of way, is it doesn't. You know, I've met lots of people who are incredibly wealthy, and if they were selfish, they would stop when they'd made 10 or 20 million or 30 million or 40 million, but they keep pursuing more and more wealth at the detriment of their health and their families and everything. They're at war with themselves. That's why psychoanalysis exists, because we do things against ourselves. Why do I keep going out with people who hurt me? Why do I do this activity that I know is problematic to me? This zombie drive is kind of, in a sense, a non-utilitarian element of being human, this drive for this object that will satisfy, this drive for some sort of object. Now, there's three issues very quickly with this. I'm going to be very quick on this one. But one of the first problems with this structure, and by the way, this could be anything for us, you know, as we grow. It could be money, it could be fame, it could be going out with that person, looking a certain way. Anything that we think will make us whole and complete that we can't quite get. We look at, I want that, and it drives us, right? First thing is, problem is, we never get it. If we get it, we realize we don't get it. So that's Hollywood films for you, you know. They always have to stop when you get the object of your desire, not 3 weeks later. You know, they stop whenever, you know, the couple kiss. They don't stop a year later when they're sitting in silent resentment in the restaurant because somebody didn't take the laundry out, right? You know, you can't do that. You can't expose them. It stops whenever the person gets to, you know, the $10 million or $30 million. It doesn't stop a year later when they're on their third holiday to the Bahamas and going, is this all that life's about, you know? Like, it was much more fun when we were robbing banks. And they're not even poor anyway. Most of these bad guys have so much money because it's not cheap to rob banks these days. This idea, this perpetual thing, and that's why I like the Roadrunner thing, is, you know, the Roadrunner has a problem when he's chasing Wile E. Coyote. Problem is, right, what happens if he catches him, right? And there's a lovely thing from Family Guy where he does, and he's having a meal, he's eating it, and he's saying to his friend, oh, you know, it's so good when you've really worked for your food. I mean, really worked for it, right? And his friend says, what are you going to do now? And he's like, well, I don't know. I've never really trained for anything else. Something will come up. And then, it, you know, it cuts to him watching daytime TV and drinking, and then he tries to kill himself with his catapult, right? Because when you get, until he finds religion, funny enough, you either, and this is why Oscar Wilde said there's only one thing worse than not getting what you want, and it's getting what you want. Because when you get what you want, you realize it's not what you want. You realize, oh my goodness. So often, I can't get this, but we often protect ourselves from it. Like somebody who always wants to get married, but at the last minute always pulls away. You kind of go like, you know, is it deep down that we know that if we got what we want, we would be exposed to the fantasy that what we want is not what we want? So it's one is, and that's the most simple thing, right? We pursue this object, and it's to our own detriment. Secondly is the more interesting one, which is not only can we not get it, but we fantasize that the other can. And that's why we hate them. So there's an old parable that says about this farmer who's working the fields, and God comes down and says, oh, you're such a faithful person. I'm going to give you whatever you want. Whatever I want, yeah, you know, you're brilliant. And he's about to speak, and then God says, no, it gets better. This is indeed a good day, because whatever I give you, I will give your neighbor double. Oh, well, then take one of my eyes, right? Take one of my eyes. And you go like, what? That's crazy. But if you think about it, like, you know that Solomon's wisdom, that the two women come to Solomon, and one of the women says, you know, she stole my child. Her child died, and she stole my child, and I want her back. And the other woman says, no, it's a lie. And then Solomon says, bring me a sword. I'll cut the child in half, right? And one of the women says, don't. What's interesting is the other woman says, go, so be it. Right, and you have to think about it. You have to go, like, at first people don't notice that. Why would a woman say, so be it, cut the child in half? Well, sometimes if what we think will make us whole and complete is stolen from us, we can so hate the other who seems to have what we think brings completion that we can want horrible things on them. That's why Gore Vidal said, every time a friend succeeds, a part of me dies, you know? It's why I hate Rob Bell. You know, it's like, oh, how many have you sold? Oh, that many books? Oh, I'm so happy. These are tears of joy. I'm so happy for you, Rob. Oh, yeah. Oh, brilliant. I'm in the tens. I'm almost in three figures, Rob. So it's like this, and that's why you see, and Hollywood films operate with it, where it's the baddie who's always the one who's having excessive pleasure, jouissance. And it's the goodie who's the one who's depressed. And I use the example of Batman and the Joker, or the Joker who is having excessive pleasure. He even has a smile etched onto his face. And it's the Batman who's depressed, right? Because you've got to, and it's the same in relationships. Whenever someone's in a relationship and you break up and you're collecting urine and bottles or whatever, and you imagine them out having a time of their life, partying, having a great time. We fantasize that the other has what we want, and And it causes this conflict. So you can see all these conflicts that arise. And then the third thing very quickly is there's a sense in which we can pretend that we have the object that we want in order to elicit pleasure. So, you know, those letters that people in America write about their kids, how their kids are amazing and going to be president of the United States when little Johnny's really got a heroin addiction and lives in a car and, you know, down the road. Is that there's a substitute pleasure for people thinking that you have the pleasure. And so that's why we know success is the sweetest revenge. If we pretend to be happy, we know we can elicit, you know, desire or revenge out of other people. So this structure is deeply, deeply problematic. Very quickly, and sadly, I think this is mimicked in the church. The church has an object God that we're separated from, like two chasms, you know, the God gas here and us unhappy sinners here, and then the cross goes in the middle and gets us, right? So it mimics this kind of structure, saying the same thing. And so the church has the same problem as any other organization that uses this model, which is once you get it and it doesn't work, what do you say? So you have to supplement. Oh, well, you need to read the Bible more, or you need to go to more conferences, or you need to do that, you need to go to seminary, or you always have to supplement, because you're like, I thought I had it. I don't have it. So I must be doing something wrong in supplementation or disavowal. We have to pretend that we're happy, and therefore whenever people are depressed, we have to get rid of them because they expose our own depression to ourselves. And there's various modes that we hide this from ourselves. But what I think is interesting is we can create, this very simply, this sense of a separation. I just want to call original sin, right? And what I mean by that is nothing moral. It's not about going out with girls who chew gum or anything like that. It's a saying that as soon as I have a sense of myself, I have a sense of a non-self. So at the very core of our being is a sense of separation, a sense of lack, is very constitutive of self-consciousness. And so in other words, it's not fullness that comes first. It's lack. And that's what the story of the painting is about. There is no full painting. It's the taking away of a painting that's mundane is what gives the illusion that there's something full. So we are constituted by lack. Sin, I describe as this drive, which obviously brings conflict to others, conflict to ourselves, and all of the stuff that we've just kind of touched on briefly. Again, it's not moral or immoral, so like doing charity work can be sin. Anything that you think will make you whole and complete is a sin, right? So in this thing, from taking drugs to having kids, whatever it is, anything that you're doing to get rid of the lack, this is this drive. And it causes all manner of problems. And that's why I think it's called the knowledge of good and evil, because in this pursuit, we enter into the realm of evil proper, the realm of the destruction of the other who has the idol. You see it with immigrants. Oh, those immigrants there, they're stealing our jobs. Those immigrants, they're stealing our welfare. These mutually exclusive terms, one, they work harder for less, and two, they're lazy. But it's like the other has something that's ours. You see it within Nazism with the figure of the Jew. You know, they have all the money, they have all the power. The other has something that we want, which generates the conflict, you know, and wars, and most wars are fought on these kinds of principles. So sin, you've got the object, I'm going to call this the idol. The idol is anything, whatever it is, the BMW or whatever it is that you think will make you whole and complete. The prohibition is the law. The law is the thing that you think holds you back from this, but actually creates it. This is the interesting thing about the law. The law is actually the very thing that degenerates the object rather than the thing that destroys it. Okay, so this is my reading in short of Adam and Eve. What's going on in Adam and Eve? And it's for me, it's a description of our own embedded psychological positioning. Now, where do I want to go with that? Okay, I've given these theological terms to it. What I think is, in Christianity, on the cross, you see something interesting. So if I draw a rectangle around this, you have basically the structure of the temple, right? You have the Holy of Holies. You have the temple curtain. You have the place, you know, where the priest is here, and you have the court of Gentiles, where you basically go and you do your sacrifices and all of that. So you have this same structure mimicked that you see from in the very beginning, redone. Now, also, this looks very like a magician's stage, right? You've got the pledge. The object. This is the object, right? For in Christianity, the object is the idol. Here is the object. You've got an object. Give me your object. We've all got it. Here's the object. Bam. And as magicians do, they put the object behind a curtain. Did it? Then they do a bit of hocus pocus. And then they rip the curtain away, and that's the turn. The object's not there. So in BC 63, a general, Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus, went to the temple, went behind the curtain, and he came back and he said, there's nothing there. Nothing there. And you see that with the first cosmonaut. He went to space. You know, he reported, didn't actually say, but the thing was, he said, God isn't there. God isn't there. There's nothing there, right? And this is the kind of the new atheist kind of claim or whatever. In the church, there's nothing there. Now, this is interesting, but here very quickly, I think if you remember nothing else, this, I think, articulates the church. There was this competition, story about a competition they ran in Ireland. And the competition was, you know, who could build the biggest sheep pen, right? Sheep pen. And it was one of these crazy TV things. It sounds like a terrible TV program, but we have crazy TV programs. When I grew up, there was a TV program called One Man and His Dog, which is literally one man and a dog getting sheep into a pen. That was, honestly, that was like what was on TV. Unbelievable. So in this competition, you know, and what they do, like all of these things, like American Idol, they have to have the rubbish people. So they have an engineer, an architect, and this farmer, this 60-year-old farmer called Seamus, and they all enter. And so they've got the three people. So the first guy comes up. He builds. They've got enough some material, and they've got a certain amount of time to build a pen. And the engineer goes first, the architect goes first, and the architect creates this really cool space using all of the material, and the pen can fit 100 sheep. Oh, well done. Then it's the engineer's turn. They come up to the engineers, the judges have a look. Well, the engineer's worked out that he can cut the material down the middle and create a pen that's four times the size. I said twice the size once, and somebody said it would be four times the size, so I remember that now. Four times the size. It was kind of spoiled the story when they said that. But and then they could fit 400 sheep. And then they come up to Seamus, and there's Seamus, all his material lying around, and he's created a pen about the size of this lectern, right? And he's standing inside painting it. And the judges laugh, and they go like, you know, what are you doing? That's tiny. You can hardly fit in the pen. And of course, Seamus says, no. He says, I'm on the outside. You're standing in it, right? Now, instead of seeing this claim by, Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus and all that, as the negative claim, it's the church that should be embracing this more fully than anyone else. This, for me, is a central insight of the crucifixion. You have this crazy moment in which the temple curtain rips, the magician's hocus pocus, bam, and we discover, yes, there's nothing in there. The thing that we thought, from the apple tree to the Holy of Holies, that would make us whole and complete, that we're pursuing relentlessly the cause of our conflicts, our sadness, our wars, our unhappiness, it's not there. Bam, the term, what's called the death of God in philosophy. There's nothing there. You won't hear that in church. But it doesn't end there. The trick doesn't end there, because the trick never ends with the turn. You have to have a prestige, otherwise people are waiting. Where is it? Where's the coin? They don't clap until you bring back the lost object. And what's interesting, I think, about Christianity is we go, the sacred object, this is the sacred object, the object that we think would make us whole and complete, is ripped down, the curtain, and the trick, of course, is the curtain actually creates the object that it looks like it's hiding. So you rip down the curtain, you rip down the law, and you realize that the object that the law creates is gone. And then you go, where is it? And this is where the resurrection comes in, because you realize that the sacred comes back. The sacred not as an object that we pursue, but as a depth dimension in all objects. God is where two or three are gathered together, where the hungry are fed, the naked are clothed. It's what Bonhoeffer talked about in Letters and Papers from Prison. You know, to live as if God is not given is to live fully before God and with God. So it was live as though God is not given, so the given object, the deus ex machina, the idol, to fully embrace the world, you experience a depth dimension in the world. And you realize that God isn't on that mountain or isn't in that place. That the role of the sanctuary is to say, yeah, of course it's empty. You're here because you think God's here. You know, if anybody came to this seminary to think God's in the middle, well, you all know it's not. And the problem is, in churches, you kind of think, well, you enter and you go, oh, this isn't really working for me, but if I got more involved, it would be better. And you almost imagine that in the very center of the church is the Holy of Holies, that when they have their private meetings, you know, Jesus is in there with a frappuccino, chatting away with the leaders, and, you know, the chorus of angels are singing. No, I've been to the center. It's the most cynical place of all, because you don't even have the prohibition, the illusion that maybe the center's good. When you're in the center, you realize how rubbish it is, and you can't pretend to yourself. So it's often the worst place to be. You see, for me, this is what Kumari, there's a documentary called Kumari, and it's about a guy who pretends to be a guru. And he's Indian American, he's from New York. He dresses up in a big robe, grows a massive beard, gets a huge staff, puts on his granny's accent, this weird crazy accent, and goes to Arizona to set up a religion. So the documentary charts this. And at first it's like, it's a bit like a joke, you know, you're laughing at the people because about 20 or 30 people start following him. And at first they're all, you know, you think they're all pathetic. And then you begin to get to know them. You realize that, no, they're just like me. You know, there's a woman there who's gone through a divorce and she has really low self-esteem and she's always bubbly and happy, but you know that she's just not happy. And there's a guy who goes around all these places to get free samples of stuff. And at first it's kind of funny. He's always going around to get free food samples. And then you realize it's because he doesn't know anyone. He's got no friends. And this is the only chance he has to actually talk to people, to talk to people who are paid to stand there. You get to know and you realize it's difficult. And he gets to realize, oh my goodness, because he wanted to expose how gurus are all frauds. That was his idea. And then he starts to feel really guilty. And he goes, I'm going to have to tell these people. How do I do it? And at first, he totally bottles it. He kind of starts saying, I'm not who you think I am. But everyone goes, oh, you're not who I think you are. You know, it's like the guru. You know, it's like a king who says, I'm not powerful. You go, okay, you're not powerful. It's the throne that makes the king powerful, not the words. So he's like, then he goes the great unveiling where he's going to tell them, but he totally doesn't do it, bottles it. But then eventually he just has to. So he comes back, shaved his beard, his regular jeans and shirt, and he stands in front of them all. Their video comes up first where he's just like, admits it, and he comes on. He says, I'm sorry, it's all a big fraud. I'm no guru. No guru. What's interesting at that point, what happens? A couple of people are really annoyed and go, but very few. One or two still maintain that he has supernatural powers, the delusion. But most of them were like, oh, they were shocked. But they realized, we've been doing it. Because as they were going through this religious activity, they were beginning to get more confident. They were beginning to transform their lives. They were thinking that he was doing it. And then in this big apocalyptic reveal, apocalypse meaning the rending of a curtain, you know, the magic trick of Christianity. And they realize, oh my goodness, he's just as broken as us. There was a sense of, oh, right, there is no person out there who's fixing it and making it good. This is a community effort. What's interesting about Kumari is I think that the very moment that he reveals that he's not a guru is actually the very moment that for a brief instant he actually is. And for me, that's actually what the church should be. People come to the church because they're looking for the Holy of Holies, the answer. They're looking for the divine. They think that the person at the front has it. And over time, maybe you help people realize, no, I don't think I do. And then ultimately, you bring them to the apocalyptic realization of the priesthood of all believers. And that's difficult. That's traumatic. And you say, you know, God is in the world, in how we live, in how we be, in how we embrace the world. And so you have then the prestige, the return of God. Let's see. How am I doing? You know, this, as you might notice, doesn't actually require. It's a reading of Christianity and of sin and of idolatry and of atonement, but that in one sense doesn't require certain metaphysical assumptions, which may or may not be true. It doesn't actually rule them out. It's basically what this is the forgiveness of sin is the way I understand it. In other words, what Christianity does is it doesn't offer the idol. The problem with apocalyptic literature today is, you know, it's all premised on this idea, which is I can imagine the whole world being destroyed. I can imagine everything ending, and then I will be fulfilled, and everything will be okay. So I will destroy the whole world. The one thing that doesn't change is the way that I desire, right? The one thing that doesn't change is the mode of my desire, the mode of my being. I remain in the same mode of creation. But now I can be fulfilled and everything will be great. What I want to argue is that the Christian apocalypse is much more radical than that. It transforms the very way in which we desire. The new creation means a new mode of being. So I don't need to destroy the world in order to get what I want. I am destroyed from within. So it's like the world is a huge vending machine with all of these products that say, if you consume this, you'll be happy, whole, and complete. You'll have the answers. Christianity, the church, often comes in and puts its product in alongside all of the other products. But what I'm arguing for is Christianity is the taking of the sledgehammer to the very structure itself. Now this, as I can't get into, but you'll also say, I think this is a critique of a certain form of frenetic capitalism, which operates on the idea that if you can have this, then everything will be good and whole and complete. And so the frenetic pursuit of new things, the new iPhones or whatever. And actually, to experience this break within the church, in terms of this different understanding of God, can actually facilitate a transformation also at a political and economic level. But that's what the forgiveness is. The forgiveness of sins is not the paying of a debt. You know, so in other words, you know, I get you across to this, you get the idol. What if forgiveness of sins means literally, like, and this is why I think it's interesting to say, like, that Christ is like money, in the sense of, you know, what does it mean to say Christ is without sin but takes sin on? Well, in the same way, money has no value but takes on all value. So money has no value in its purest form, but represents all value. So when the Christian says Christ has no sin but represents all sin, it's a similar thing. So Christ is without this gap, without this being, which means fully human. So if you know, you'd imagine the early disciples would describe this mode of being as fully human, which doesn't mean like us, of course. It means unlike us, because we are not, you know, we're like, you've got the alien figure. And to say someone is fully human is to say they're as distant from us as saying they're fully God, you know. We are like the missing link between kind of animals and humans in some respects. So this fully human being, you know, without the lack, fully immersed in the ground of being, fully at one with themselves, then experiences the lack. So if that happened, you'd expect them to cry out something like, my God, why have you forsaken me? As in experience a lack, experience a separation. And then you would expect the whole system to break. And that's the temple curtain ripped open. And psychologically, I think that's what conversion is, the undergoing of this experience in one's being. And so the forgiveness of sins is, the other thing about money, by the way, is money is a concretization of nothingness, of debt. Debt is nothingness, so I owe you something. It's like, people think it's bartering, money comes from bartering. You know, you have two chickens, you have a cow, and so you swap. No, it didn't really start like that, because often one person needs two chickens, the other person doesn't need a cow. So you give your neighbor what they need, and you say, you owe me one. So in the future, you can give me something back. So money came to represent debt, nothingness. Sin, as I'm arguing, is an experience of nothingness, a void, a sense of separation of nothingness. For me, forgiveness of sin is like the year of Jubilee, where the debt is rendered debtless, the nothing is rendered nothing. It's not paid, it's paid in the sense of it's like forgiven. To forgive, said it's no longer valid. That is the sledgehammer that takes place on this mode of desire, this old creation, so that we enter into a new creation. And this is all linked. The transgression, the law is linked to the transgression, is linked to the drive. You rip away the law, you experience love in which everything's permissible, not everything's beneficial, but the law which says yes, and you experience a new modality of life. And that, I think, is why I think, you know, Christianity has something interesting to say. And ultimately then, I'll finish with this, I think, a reflection of what this looks like, and then we've got time for discussion, and we'll go kind of a bit deeper into it, because I don't want to take all the time talking. But there's a story from back home about this rich Texan who, wants to go back to Ireland to discover his roots. His great-great-grandfather left Ireland a long, long time ago. And so he goes back, and he discovers that he still has blood relatives there. And so he goes to this little house, this little farmhouse. He knocks on the door, and this guy comes out, Seamus. You know, Seamus goes, oh, how's it going? My name's Seamus. And Texan introduces himself and then brings him in. They have a cup of tea, and the Texan says, are you going to show me around? And Seamus says, yeah, come on out. So brings him outside and looks around. He says, yeah, you know, you see that tractor there? He says, that's all my land to there. And you see that tree stump right beside you? That's mine. To that picket fence into the house. He says, yeah, you know, that's my land. And the Texan laughs. And he says, back home, he says, I can get in my car and I can drive all day north. At the end of the day, I wouldn't get to the end of my land. Or I could drive all day south. I wouldn't get to the end of my land at the end of the day. All day east, all day west. And Seamus goes, he says, I know how you feel. He says, I used to have a car like that as well. Right? Now, that What's going on in that story, I think, captures this. Is the text in it saying, I have the thing which will make me whole and complete. I have this money. I have this stuff, right? He's doing that. He's playing that game. He's caught up in the structure of the idol and the desire, and he's playing this game. But Seamus, in the Christ-like response, is just, he says, yeah, I'm broken too. I'm broken as well. And that's when you notice that whenever someone says, I have it all, it's great, you know, I've got it all, I've got the answers, I've got it. When you kind of look at it, you just go, yeah, sometimes I have to pretend as well, because life's difficult. That's the good news of Christianity for me. Not that you can be whole and that you can have the answers. That's really bad news. Because the more you think you've got the answers, the more insecure you are, and the less you can cope with people who think differently, the more you push them away. The more you think you can be happy and whole and complete, the more unhappy you are, the more jealous you are and resentful you are of other people, and the more you hurt yourself. And actually, the good news is we're all lacking. We're all full of doubts and unknowing. And as we let go of the idol with the breakdown of the law, the turn of Christianity, the hocus pocus, we experience a freedom to really find joy in life. This is why Kierkegaard in Either Or says, you know, under a pseudonym, he says, there's people in the world who live dejectedly in both sorrow and joy. And what he says, when you're watching people dance, it looks beautiful and graceful, but watch for when they hit the ground, and a slight grimace betrays the truth. So in psychoanalysis, it's the same thing. Is, you know, Freud says it's almost impossible for people to lie. If you really look at them, you'd think it's impossible. Because whatever they say with their lips, you know, the tapping of their fingers tells you the truth, right? And you can see this, like, you know, the idea that, you know, you go to a bar and everybody looks really happy and having a great time. But if you turn on the lights and turn off the music, everybody would be crying within 30 seconds, right? Or it's the idea that you can see in the person who's looking at their mobile phone, the person who's holding a beer in their hand because, you know, to protect themselves from the other, that all of the two people kissing but looking like they're floundering and knowing, not sure of the pleasure that they're getting or receiving. All of this stuff's going on, you know, all over. But then there's this other mode of being where you can experience joy in the midst of sorrow, worldly sorrow and happiness. That somehow in the midst of the suffering and brokenness in life, you can, I would say, by being freed from this idol and this idolatry, feel a fullness of life, an experience of the depth of existence. And that for me is what life in all its fullness means. It doesn't mean the continuation of life into all eternity, because that would be horrible. You know, if I cannot help you enjoy your life and I extend it forever, I'd be a devil. You know, be accursed. I'd be cursing you. What if I was able to help you experience the depth of your being, a life before you die? And then maybe that continues on. But first and foremost, a different modality of life before you die. Not the question of is life possible after death, but the much more interesting and difficult question, is life possible before we die? Now, I think we've got some time to kind of like dissect this a little bit more. So, you know, if you want, you can obviously slip out, but there's a lot more we can talk about. So there's going to be a roving mic, which is going to be this one. And if you've got a question, if you just kind of put up your hand and the mic will come to you, and then we'll have a little bit of a discussion and then take it from there. So if you've got a question, put up your hand.
Question over here. Much appreciated your presentation, and you're obviously very oriented towards psychoanalysis.
Yep.
So I want to get to Freud. You mentioned him. What do you think of Freud's idea that religion and spirituality and God are delusions?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very critical of religion as well. So I mostly go with the critique of religion that you find in Marx, Freud, Nietzsche, Feuerbach. That religion often is an identity marker, a belief, a system of belief to protect us from a confrontation with our own brokenness and unknowing. The difference is, I think Christianity is anti-religious. Now, the problem with saying that is that's kind of said by some. I mean, I've got a chapter in Insurrection which is called I'm not religious, and other religious sayings, right? So sometimes the church kind of says, we're not religious, and that's kind of the most religious thing you can say. But I mean strictly that Christianity for me is is not a religion at its core. It's most radical. It's not a religion. It's not a set of beliefs. It's not a cosmology. It's not an anthropology. It's not a tradition. It's the critique of those. It's an event that ruptures all ideological systems, including Christianity. So to be a Christian is to betray Christianity. Strangely, the fidelity of betrayal, and that's the constant thing of the church for me, is betraying itself to remain faithful to it. And the reason why I think it's anti-religion, in a sense, is, again, which we didn't get into, but the very nature of the cross is the loss of all identity. Stuff we talked about in the classes this afternoon is how Paul lists a number of identities, Jew, Gentile, slave, free, male, female, and sees Christianity as the cutting across of those identities. That you, as you identify with Christ, you identify with a sense of the loss of your own identity. So I what I would say is I think Christians need to take seriously the Freudian critique, and that's why we have a thing called Atheism for Lent, where we read all the great atheistic critiques. We read Freud, we read Marx, we read Nietzsche as Lenten readings, partly to experience, my God, why have you forsaken me, which is kind of the end of Lent, but also hopefully to see that these critiques, which are called the masters of suspicion, right, actually are within Christianity as well. I mean, if you want a critique of religion, my goodness, you know, read Kierkegaard. You know, it's as vicious as any. He says, if you want to sin one less time, I mean, no matter what you do, if you want to sin one less time, stop going to church, right? That's one of Kierkegaard's kind of essays. I mean, Kierkegaard was so what I'm interested in, and they're called the masters of recollection, is saying amidst all the craziness, there's something great. So the short answer to what you're saying is, yeah, I actually think that that we need to read these people seriously, take seriously their critiques, and that actually they'll open up a much deeper and richer vein of what Christianity, I think, can be.
Yeah. Hi. You've spoken of our loss of identity. Mm. In church, one could aspire that it be a place where we meet and face and confront each other in a safe space with commitment to our dignity. How do we, if we do that, how do we retain our diversity? If we love to meet the stranger and learn his language, how do we maintain our own? We have to practice both, don't we? We need our private home spaces too. The church isn't home, it's the place between our faces, between our homes. So my question essentially is, if diversity is good, how do we maintain it when we meet each other frankly?
Yeah, so if I've got you right, yeah, I go, the actual way to maintain diversity for me is to have what I would call a desert in the oasis. And a desert in the oasis is this space that you can go to performatively lay down your identities, become aware of those, and so that you can meet the other. So Republicans and Democrats and all of that meet together in a space. And then when you leave, you take up those identities again, because you can't actually live without your identities. It's like you want to create an echo of some sort of utopian future. You want to create a moment, a performative moment. But then you argue not as enemies anymore. You meet as friends because you gathered around this Eucharistic space. So for me, this role of this desert-like space is so that conflicts can continue to rage and diversity can continue to rage without entering into some sort of like devastating result. And as I talked about earlier today, you know, war is the result, and war is not a conflict. War is the inability to do conflict. So you enter into war when you just want to kill the other person, right? You don't want to have a conflict. Real conflict is when you enter into play. So pacifism is the true conflictual discourse, you know, but because war is the sense of I don't want to listen to you. Bang, right? You're dead, right? So for real conflict to happen, I think you need to create these spaces where you encounter each other, and then real conflict can occur. In ICON, we create what we call equal opportunities offense. Whatever you are, we're going to offend you, because often in order to see your identity, we have to bring it to the surface and poke fun at it. But the way we do that to not raise defense mechanisms is we kind of take the piss out of everybody. We attack everybody. And then you kind of go, oh, I don't really actually feel bad because they attack conservatives or they attack liberals. We attack everybody, but only ourselves, not the other. It's the AA community where you can either create a community by mutual hatred of another outside, a scapegoat, or you create community by seeing the brokenness within the community and trying to facilitate that. Does that touch on anything? I think you're saying something similar. Is that right? Or I'm all for diversity, but what I think is the liturgical space is, well, the liturgical space for me is that desert. It's also, by the way, I mean, I'm talking about the magic trick. The one thing I didn't say is, I think we enact this in the Eucharist. What you've got is, you've got the pledge. Here is the bread and the wine, God. Then you've got the turn, the disappearance in the body. And then you're waiting for the prestige. And you realize, oh, we are the body. We're the body of God. So interestingly, you know, that's what we do. We gather around and we performatively enact this magic trick in this transformation together. And then when we go out into the world, we say, well, we are this body of God together in our diversity. It's a different reading of the Eucharist, but I think it works.
Yeah. You mentioned that Christ is fully God and takes on humanity. Is that somehow separate from Christ being fully human and encouraging us to take on divinity?
Say it again, sorry.
You said that Christ is fully God and takes on humanity, basically gives the presence or the appearance of humanity. And I'm wondering if that is different from Christ fully taking on being human and encouraging us to take on divinity.
Okay, if I've got your... And so what all I'm saying is within the Christian narrative, you have this sense of, you know, a being who is without the lack is fully God, you know, fully at one with the ground of being, of course, and then fully human, as in fully without the kind of constitutive lack that puts us at war with ourselves. So the early Christian community seems to be, you know, making a claim. And because of that claim, you'd expect them to say fully God and fully human. So that's the kind of the claim. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not arguing, of course, for, you know, whether literal or metaphorical or anything like that, but just this early testimony and how it fits with this. But I mean, obviously, what I would like to say is, yeah, you know, if the what's interesting about Christianity is, you know, all of us want to be gods. We all want certainty. We all want satisfaction. We all want to have the God's eye view. But what's interesting is you have this idea of God becoming human. So to become human is to become fully human. And by the way, and just I need to say this, this connects with it a little bit. This connects with the reading of the dark glass. You know, when Paul says you see through a glass darkly, but then you will see fully, you know in part and then you shall know wholly. I mean, I can't tell, every interpretation of that verse I can see either basically falls down to, you know, before Christ, before special revelation, we saw through a glass darkly, but now we know fully, right? That there's a fullness and we can have. Or, well, we're currently in a place of unknowing, but we one day will have knowing. So the desire to be God, we'll one day know as we're known, we'll know fully that there is a fullness to be known. But that's just reading something into the verse that's not there. There's another way of reading it, which is in this way, that Paul is making a claim to Christianity. He's saying that it's the dark glass itself that creates the illusion that there's something behind it that makes something look full. So the partial gaze onto something behind it would make us whole and complete is actually created, an illusion created by the dark glass itself. You smash the dark glass and you fully realize there's nothing that will make you whole and complete. Not a scientific, empirical realization, a psychological grasp and embrace of the brokenness and unknowing. So it's, you know, and I think you can read it through the dark glass as this, as Paul's kind of almost in a sense mimicking the temple, mimicking the Garden of Eden, which mimics the magician's stage, is that you strip this away and we fully embrace our humanity. To be fully Christian is to fully embrace that humanity.
So I'm very appreciative of the thought process that's going on here. I'm struggling, however, with thinking about who the we are and who the you may be. As I think about what you shared, and I think about it in kind of a first world, perhaps imperial context, the idea, I mean, a lot of the metaphors you used of killing others or taking things seems like it connotes a certain kind of power that we have. So I'm thinking about people on the other side of empire, people who've been crushed by it. The good news is you, as I heard you say it, was that our identities, ourselves, I may be using other words, but that somehow they're obliterated, that we find that's part of the good news. For people who have been obliterated by empire, however, who have not been allowed to have a self, who aren't welcome to the magic trick. They have to come in through the back door and sit outside sometimes. I wonder how this is what you've shared today, how it's good news for them.
Yeah, and I said, now, the one thing I would say, you know, And I think it's a really good question. It's a question that comes up sometimes. But this is where I kind of pull out my, and it's a trick. I'm going to do a trick here. I'm going to pull out a trump card and go, I did this in Northern Ireland. I'm from Northern Ireland. I'm from like a crazy conflict and like civil war situation. But that's a trick in a sense, you know, like I can play my, look, you know, this grew up in a conflict situation. That doesn't in itself answer the question. But I do have to say that because, you know, this wasn't brought up in a university setting or anything like that. This was in a context, yeah, where identities were very important, and some people were being very oppressed, and it's a, you know, different contexts in different places. But Northern Ireland, identity markers, you know, there was a lot of oppression and violence, and we find that creating this space, strangely, I mean, it's dialectic. For me, it's like as you open yourself up to the other's identity, as you critique your own, as you allow the other person to be an instrument for your further transformation, it creates, when you leave that space, I think, a healthier way of maintaining identities. The most difficult identity to give up in some respects is white male, because you don't experience it as an identity. You know, it's like, you know, you don't, you're like, you're the zero sum. And so, you know, that's probably in some respects it's the most difficult identity, because it's not an identity. It's what is. So it's, for me, you have to try and shift this. But I see this in, I wonder if I can connect this with Paul and Paul's conversion, where, Well, so Paul has this conversion, and what's interesting about it is, you know, he's doing a scapegoating thing. He's got his religion. There's an internal set of contradictions and challenges, and he's blaming this nascent group called Christians, this new group. You know, if they're the problem, get rid of them and everything will be good. So same with the fascist, with the Jew or whatever. If only we could get rid of these guys, then everything would be great. And then, of course, he gets the central insight, which is what you see in the Gospels, is, he has this insight where, why are you persecuting me? He realizes that the scapegoat is where God is. So that's what, on the cross, obviously, the person, we get rid of Christ and everything will be okay. And he realizes, oh my goodness, that's the Son of God. In the same way, the persecuted group of this group called Christians, you realize that in persecuting them, they're God. In other words, they are what will bring salvation to Paul. That he realizes that he's putting his external darkness and his brokenness onto this community. Now he has to bring that back on himself. He goes blind, so it's a revelation of darkness. He as the oppressor, goes through this transformation. But Ananias, I think it's Ananias, is one of the persecuted, one of the people who had been, you know, persecuted by Paul and his people. And I don't mean people as in, these people choose like some sort of anti-Semitism, because actually I want to say this context, I think, is already going on within Judaism. The law for me is not the Jewish law. This is not the Jewish law. It's actually the Christian law and the Roman law, because the Jewish law doesn't create this desire to transgress the prohibition. Just as a very quick example, you know, Christian mysticism generates an overabundance of talk about God. Jewish mysticism doesn't. It doesn't. It's not a transgression that generates its libidinal opposite. It brings you into a grounded way of engaging with your world. But like Paul and the people who were with him persecuting, Ananias has to invite Paul in and welcome this repentance. And that's the difficult thing, is that not only do the oppressors have to undergo a transformation, realize who they are oppressing is actually the place of God, which is the crazy insight, the insight that what the very person that you think is the scapegoat is where your salvation rests. But then the really challenging thing in a peace process is the oppressed, in some respects, have to forgive. And that's, I don't know how that works, but I've seen it in Northern Ireland and with also Nelson Mandela and all of that kind of stuff. This kind of process, and you know, it's very, very difficult to do. And I don't know if that's answering your question at all, but there's just some thoughts. we can talk more about it. I'd love to hear more of your thoughts, you know. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I hope we get to talk more informally. Cheers.